It's episode 112 of the Presentable Podcast, and I'm your host, Jeff Veen. Today on the program is Genevieve Gaudet. She's the Director of Design for Nava, a firm focused on service design for the public sector. We talk about the power of design to transform the way people experience their government. Genevieve, thanks so much for being on the show. It's great to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm such a big fan.
Oh, thank you. Gosh. Now, look, I was looking at your CV before we got started here. So I know you spent some time working in the New York City mayor's office under Bill de Blasio, right? And I want to hear about that and the work you did over there. But before we do that, you must be super interested in the current mayor race that's going on in New York, right?
To be honest, I moved to Los Angeles about 2 years ago and have gotten a lot more focused on what we're doing over here on the West Coast. I'm a little embarrassed to admit that I'm not following the...
No, don't be embarrassed. It's like local politics is messy.
It is. It's so messy. I see the occasional Twitter updates go by on my screen and I'm just like, oh, I can't follow this.
I've been watching. I find it interesting because like I lived for a while in San Francisco and I think New York and San Francisco are very similar in that the primaries are what's interesting because whoever gets the Democratic nomination is going to end up winning inevitably, right? In both of those cities. So I've been watching a little bit in the New York Times as it's been going and it looks like there's going to be some interesting changes. So that's good.
I think so. I think we need them. So
yeah, for sure. For sure. You are a design director. You practice, it sounds like primarily service design. I want to hear all about that, but it'd be great to sort of trace or connect the dots of your career, how you got started in this and sort of the steps along the way to where you are now.
Sure. Well, it really starts kind of far back. Honestly, the day that I was set to start college, which was in New Orleans at Tulane University, in the city I grew up in, New Orleans, nice. Great place. The day I was set to start Tulane, Hurricane Katrina devastated the city.
Wow.
And when it opened back up that January, there was a severe shortage of medical staff in the city. And so I became trained as an EMT and spent the rest of my college career as a pre-med student and full-time EMT in addition to doing my coursework. And so I saw very up close what happens when there's a broken public health system, how that impacts people who live there, and sort of the enormous power involved in having a functioning system of governance and in being able to provide very basic services to people that kind of keep them healthy, keep their basic needs met, and so on. And it really started this whole trajectory where, first, I went to public health school for graduate school, and at the time didn't have language for this, but was basically prototyping apps and websites and kind of redoing, a content strategy for messaging campaigns to make them stickier. And sort of along the way found my professional people who said, oh, there's words for this. These are apps and, you're prototyping things, and was able to sort of build up some of those tools of the trade to support what were very, bold but kind of academic ambitions around impact and around impacting people in a positive way, and eventually made my way to Nava, where I am now.
That's quite a shift from pre-med.
It was a big shift, but it's I feel like it comes from the same place. Right. There's still that intention of like, what can I contribute, to our collective well-being, and what can I do?
Right. And so you in between there, you spent some time, like we said at the beginning of the show, in the New York City mayor's office.
I did. Yeah. When I, right after graduate school, I moved to New York City, and spent a fair amount of time at, design studios, focused again on social impact work. Civic tech was sort of, just getting its name around the time then. So, there wasn't a whole lot of, I think, identity, at least not for me within that industry yet. But then things like Civic Hall started in New York, and I was really drawn into that community and honestly was just very persistent about showing up at events and getting people to talk to me. And eventually a very fruitful conversation with Frank Hebert, who started Open Plans, you know, kind of at the beginning of the civic tech, first civic tech wave in the U.S., suggested that I meet a woman named Ariel Kennan, who was trying to start an interesting group in the mayor's office. And when I did, we Ariel and I clicked just right away, and I agreed to join her in co-founding a service design studio for Mayor de Blasio. And that turned into a really, you know, just all-star team that is there today, and they work on increasing economic opportunity for New Yorkers and, you know, improving the public services that serve all the folks in New York.
And in that context, was that a particular like technological effort? And you mentioned civic tech. I've had a couple of people on the show that have, you know, backgrounds in the U.S. Digital Service and things like that. So the connection there in New York as well, is there a similar sort of like a group of people working on digital solutions, or was it broader than that?
There's absolutely a group of people working in New York on these things, many of whom had connections either to the U.S. Digital Service or to Code for America, who's been a long time sort of advocate and incubator for folks who go on to become leaders in the field. And Ariel had been involved with Code for America before the mayor's office. So it was certainly at the time still a growing community, but it was thriving. You know, we'd gotten enough credit sort of as an industry that the mayor was investing in this new team, and Civic Hall was a growing sort of presence at the time. Yeah, I would say it certainly branched off from that early days USDS work, but was related and had a lot of the same characters involved.
Right. What's always impressed me with that, I guess that group of characters, but also the kind of the movement within government around that was not just more of a focus on, I don't know, better user experience, or at least user-centered experience, like I think was a novel concept that happened, let's say, 10 years ago, maybe a little longer. But also sort of trying to transform the way government projects were bid on and sold and granted and, you know, and things like that. Trying to say, like, maybe we can make things smaller and faster. And I don't mean this sort of like move fast and break things, but more like just a little bit more transparent, and to be able to take on maybe smaller projects and accomplish things faster than you would with these enormous government contracts the way they had always been. So I've always found that really interesting in how it's been transformative.
Yeah, well, I think that in the U.S., there is this huge spend on technology and government. It's like $160 billion industry. And for this spend, there's like an estimated failure rate. I would have to look up the source, McKinsey poll somewhere or something, where those software projects fail at like 93%.
Oh, yeah. It's outrageous. Yeah.
Yeah. And so they're so big. It's so complicated. And you're right. A lot of this work and, you know, even today, you know, I'm continuing to advocate for smaller projects, smaller proof points that really build up momentum, because there's incredible cost just in terms of, you know, that's the size of the spend of our collective money. But also there's human cost, you know, to having all of these projects fail. And if we can reverse that first in small ways, it kind of builds the case to have a more transformative approach to the way we build these things.
Yeah, for sure. Especially if you could, it's so easy to draw the line between the dollars and people getting help from services that they need, right? And those budgets being continuously sort of underfunded while all of the software or technology projects are failing, you know?
Oh, absolutely.
Hard to.
I mean, when you think about, you know, just the amount of money we've spent on, say, maintaining SNAP systems, which, you know, are managed state to state. So we've got...
I'm not familiar with those. Can you tell me SNAP?
Yeah. So SNAP is, SNAP, let's see, it stands for the Supplemental Nutrition, I'm going to forget the A, program, but it is what used to be called food stamps. It's a way to help mostly families supplement their food budgets to buy food each month. And, you know, these systems are maintained state to state. So there are a lot of them, which means there's a lot of contracts out there for these big systems to either be maintained or rebuilt or occasionally improved. But many of them are quite brittle. They may be old, which is not a bad thing, but they're often quite brittle. And so you'll see situations where a state's website closes every day at 5.
Huh.
For maintenance. You know, there are these backend systems that maybe all the applications that day have to be sent over to the case management system. Wow. And this is such a delicate process that anything incoming might break it. And so the only way the folks maintaining that system can know to manage it is they shut the website down. And so that means if you work a job where you can't apply before 5, then what are you going to do? It means your family maybe loses out on an opportunity to buy food that month because you couldn't apply in time, or it just makes it harder. And the human costs kind of pile up as a result of these decisions and constraints that are entirely a function of the technology, you know, not usually like because of any, you know, political need or actual constraint if we just invested a little bit more in the way this was built.
Yeah, for sure. I want to hear more about that in a minute. We're going to take a little break and we'll be right back. This episode of Presentable is brought to you by Discourse. Discourse was founded in 2013 by Jeff Atwood from Stack Overflow, Robin Ward, and Sam Safran. It's a powerful, flexible, open source community platform where discussions are searchable so you can find all the relevant details for your project. The platform is designed with moderation in mind, helping you keep the discussion on track and high value while minimizing the impact of trolls and spam. It integrates with Zapier, Patreon, Memberful, and lots more. I use Discourse almost every day. There's a number of online communities for electronic music that I like to hang out in and chat with people. And I think the way Discourse does the conversations is the best I've seen. It works great on mobile, and it has this wonderful sort of incentivizing system, badges and things like that, totally controlled by the community, which get way past kind of a lot of the social media of trying to collect likes and things like that, and really kind of encourages some really great behavior. I totally encourage you to check it out. If you want to run your own community on it, Discourse offers a 100% free 14-day trial. After that, plans start about $100 per month, and the folks at Discord are giving Presentable listeners 50% off your first 2 months after you start your subscription, which is just a great deal. Go to discourse.org, that's discourse.org. Use the coupon code RELAY2021 when signing up, and you'll get 50% off your first 2 months. I also wanted to mention that they've got a new offering called Discourse for Teams. It's perfect for smaller teams or businesses looking to use Discourse to collaborate because it's private, focused Discourse instance with added features, including a new sidebar, automatic icebreakers, team updates, and more to help teams work together more effectively. There isn't currently an offer code for Teams, but plans start at $20 a month. And if you want to learn more about that, you can go to teams.discourse.com. So our thanks to Discourse for their support of this show and all of Relay FM. All right. So I would love to hear then a little bit about where you are now. You are at a firm called Nava. It's a public benefits corporation, which is interesting in itself, I think. As I was looking through the website, part of the values of the company that's listed there really struck me, which was just this phrase, to transform how people experience government. And I just love that because it puts together a bunch of things that normally don't go together in my head. You know, the idea of experiencing government, that government, like those services could be actually an experience rather than at best a chore, at worst I'd love to hear a little bit about like what you do there and the approach and all of that.
Sure. Yeah, and I think first I'll say that you know, the work we do at NAVA, I think would be important in any decade, but is particularly important and urgent right now. Because, you know, again, there have been many polls that support this. Trust in public institutions has eroded to catastrophic lows. And, you know, we see people in the U.S., in places around the world, people are demanding political change. And one of the biggest reasons is that folks no longer believe that their governments are working for them. And at NAVA, you know, we have a very specific domain we operate in, which is helping governments improve their digital services. And within those services, there are, I like to think about opportunities to fulfill small promises, which is, you know, kind of a basic measure of respect. If you need help filling out a form, you can find someone, you can call someone who's actually going to help you without kind of being bounced from call center to call center. Or, you know, sometimes we're working on programs that fulfill much larger promises, like if you've served in the military and you've had a catastrophic injury, the VA should be able to make good on your appeal for a financial benefit. And that's one of the programs that we work on at NAVA. So you can get that care when you return to civilian life. And if we're able to make good on those promises, we can then build back some of that trust. And what's so cool as a technologist is that there is an opportunity to be a part of that. You know, this is a complicated industry kind of domain to operate in because there is, you know, all of this policy, there's politics, but there is an incredible point of leverage around just what technology can provide to these services and to kind of make it more possible for public institutions to meet people's needs in a respectful and humane way.
Yeah. So where do you even start on a project like, or not a project, but a mission like that? I guess it's a series of projects that get broken down into a series of wins that you were sort of mentioning. But it seems like the problem is enormous. And I just wonder, like, you know, how do you start to break down some of the projects that you're working on and get into?
Yeah. So we start at NAVA by really heavily qualifying any projects we're considering. I think a lot of firms do this, and we're really running through our values, our mission, our vision, and whether there are forward-thinking government leaders who would be partnering with us on this. You know, this is the work, I think, of a few generations and of many people in it. So, you know, we can't be the only ones sort of advocating for this approach. So this is a very heavy qualification process. And then when we do enter into these projects, we are often looking, kind of as you intuited at the beginning of our conversation, for opportunities to build up some quick wins, to build up some credibility and momentum in a project. And so this might look like, you know, really relying on some of the classic tools of our trade as designers, you know, looking for opportunities to prototype and pilot a much better experience, looking for high leverage points of intervention where we can dramatically, you know, improve or speed up a critical point in the process. And then we sort of build out from there.
Yeah. You know, in my experience in consulting back years ago, I remember making proposals like that, where like, look, let's just start 6 weeks. We'll do a little update of the login page, right? And, or for example, and understanding that that particular page touched 15 different departments, had, you know, different technology stacks that were incompatible, that were trying to, you know, service just the back end of that one page. And so you could, so it was something that everybody very easily would agree to. Sure, login page, sure, whatever, fine, you know, that's true. It could be a little easier to log in. And it turns out that that 6 week project is actually 6 or 9 or 12 months worth of unpacking and just getting to the quick win. Uncovers just everything that's going on behind the scenes.
Absolutely. One of the things we talk about a lot at NAVA is about how so many of these problems are not technology problems at all. They're communication problems, they're collaboration issues, you know, between departments or between groups. And you're absolutely right. You know, these projects can surface a lot of that. But when, you know, sort of continually scoped tighter and tighter, we can find opportunities to, you know, maybe allow two of those agencies that were at odds that you were describing to actually collaborate together just a little bit and kind of come to their own solution. And as we can create more of that connective tissue, we found that there's an opportunity to build up champions and advocates for this way of working within government. And that's, you know, I think a big part of the long-term change we'll need if we want public services to be built in a much more people-centered, you know, in a sort of forward-thinking way.
Yeah. You mentioned the SNAP program, and I saw something you forwarded to me about the project you did in Vermont, which sounded very much sort of aligned around that strategy. But what struck me about it is as you were doing the project was having you as designers presenting to the legislature, right? To sort of convince them to go ahead with the project and give it more funding and stuff like that. And I was like, wow, now there's, you know, like designers lobbyist is not something we've covered on this podcast yet. So I thought that was super interesting. Tell me a little bit about that.
Oh, that was an incredibly fun experience. And again, one of the reasons that project was so successful was because we had Cassandra Madison, who at the time was sort of director of the Vermont Health Access Agency. And she, you know, was kind of our internal champion for working in this way, for building things in this way. And she's the one who brought us into those legislative presentations. It was an incredible amount of fun. You know, we thought a lot about, you know, how do we want to tell this story, you know, to these senators and to these representatives, and what is going to be really compelling? Because at the end of the day, you know, legislatures appropriate money, and they are the ones who are kind of signing off on that collective investment in building technology in this way. And so what we decided to do was, you know, we crafted a narrative around what we did and why it was so cool and what the outcomes were. But we also had them on their phones demo themselves the little app that we had built. And that particular small pilot, tightly scoped, was to allow Vermonters to upload documents from their phones to send to the state. And this is really important because when you apply for something like food assistance, so SNAP or food stamps, health insurance, help with housing, almost anything, you often have to submit proof of different things like who you are, how much money you make, you know, that your kids are in school, things like that. And in Vermont at the time, you had two options. You could bring those papers in person, which is expensive just in terms of time and labor, or you could mail them, which just takes a long time and delays the amount of time to actually get your application processed and the help you need, which is your whole goal in applying for this. And so we built and piloted what's called the Uploader. So it's a very simple app. You upload from your phone. In the first iteration of it, it just emailed it to your caseworker. Not sexy technology by any stretch. And that's what we had these senators and representatives just do it from their phone on their own, you know, many of whom were not super comfortable with their phones. And they were able to do it successfully. And I think that was, you know, just a great proof point that with no introduction, no training involved in this technology, you can use this. So can Vermonters. This is a great investment that, you know, at the time we knew sped up people getting their decisions about their application faster. It sped it up to 4 days, where before it took 9 days, so well over a week. Mm-hmm. And we also found that people were submitting within 1 day of hearing from the state that, you know, we need proof of how much money you make or your address, compared to like 11% of people were able to do that before. So bumping that up to 55% just means that, one, people can just move through this process so much more quickly. And folks who really do need help, maybe in person, folks who are relying on mail and things like that, caseworker time is freed up to really focus on those folks who, for whatever reason, don't want to or can't use technology.
That sounds great. And wow, the live demo, super risky. You did it, though.
I was so nervous before that. I was giving a presentation about demos the other day, and I said, demos are incredibly high risk. We should do them anyway. And that was a time that I really had to commit to that.
I have done some live demos in my day, and always with just a whole room of engineers with their hands like hovering over keyboards, you know, like waiting for to cut over to the third set of servers that we have in backup. And
Absolutely. Just hold your breath.
Exactly. That's right. That's right. Well, let's take a little break and we'll be right back. This episode is brought to you by Pingdom from SolarWinds. If you have a website, what purpose does it serve? It might be driving people to your products or collecting sales leads for your company or providing customer service with a contact form. When these critical transactions fail, you lose out on business, not to mention the bad experience for your users. But there is a solution, and that's transaction monitoring from Pingdom. It starts at just $10 a month, and transaction monitoring runs checks 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And it will alert you when cart checkout forms or login pages fail before they affect your customers and your business. Pingdom will notify you the moment there's a failure. They'll send you an SMS or an email or via your favorite apps like Slack or Ops Genie or even PagerDuty. Depending on what's being monitored or the severity of the outage, you can customize who's alerted and how they get the notification. Don't let your users discover a problem with your website. You should be the first to know, and it's super easy to get started. Just go to pingdom.com/relayfm right now for a 30-day free trial with no credit card required. Then, when you're ready to buy, use code PRESENTABLE at checkout. You get a huge 30% off your first invoice. So thanks to Pingdom from SolarWinds for their support of this show and all of Relay FM. So I think it's probably been now a couple of years ago, we did an episode of this podcast with Andy Lewandowski from the U.S. Digital Service. Do you know Andy?
I don't know him in person, but by reputation.
Oh, okay, because he's great. You're right. Yeah, he does have a wonderful reputation. Yeah. He and I talked about this epic redesign they did of the Veterans Administration website that spanned, I mean, it was crazy, thousands of stakeholders and years of navigating government everything. Like, it was really impressive. But one of the things he talked a lot about was the challenges of involving users in government projects, right? And he want to bring the actual users in to do research, to do validation, to do discovery and things like that. I'm wondering if you've experienced that challenge as well, or ways of navigating around it.
I have absolutely experienced this challenge before, though I will say that over the last few years, increasingly folks who are running projects for the government, people who are kind of soliciting, you know, consultants, it is becoming just sort of the expectation and table stakes that we will involve users in our design process. But it can sometimes be a challenge to really actually make that happen.
Sure.
I've found that compensating folks for their time can be challenging in government, especially if you're working in the public benefit space, because sometimes, you know, there's concerns around, like, is this income that then, you know, they'd need to claim on their application, where we ask them about their income, and it can really get very involved very quickly. The ways that we've found to manage this are, one, to create a sort of testing and recruiting strategy that really helps our government stakeholders feel confident that we are going to, recruit a cohort of users that are representative of the population they're trying to reach. So, you know, that we are going to commit to having a diverse and inclusive cohort. I think, you know, kind of helps them see, like, oh yeah, we're going to get feedback from kind of the full set of folks who will be using this, and we can see how that is going to be valuable. And then when it comes to just sort of the operations of making that happen, making sure that we are really kind of holding their hand through, like, here's how we recruit, here's how we manage, you know, the list of people, here's what the sessions look like, you know, allowing people to sit in on them and everything, has been really helpful, because it's sort of a weird process. And I think it can feel really risky if the ways that you are accustomed to engaging with constituents is through maybe really spicy op-eds and harsh phone calls that get routed in through a senator's office. And, you know, that's the reality for some leaders in government, is that when they do hear from people, it's that something has gone wrong. And it can be some work to really get them comfortable with the idea that we will kind of continually engage people, and we will hear some of that. But often I found that, a lot of the people we recruit are so excited because no one's ever asked them about their experience trying to get health insurance in the state of Vermont, or, you know, applying for leave in Massachusetts. And, you know, folks want to tell their stories, and it's really powerful to hear them and to allow our stakeholders to really hear them.
You know, that's interesting. That probably gets right down to the core of what you were talking about earlier around people's mistrust in government and dissatisfaction with how things are going, particularly in America, but I don't think it's exclusive to America. But that dichotomy or tension between, like, the government as them, you know, and likewise, like, my constituents as a bunch of people that are going to scream at me, right? So I better, like, turn it on and, you know, be that personality. It's a very different dynamic than what we are trying to achieve with service design and user-centered design and co-design and all of those things, which is very much being in service of a community. I don't know. That's one of the things that has been a shift for me in the past number of years around this idea as designers being of service. Mm-hmm. And not being like the people who think it up and create it all and the experts, right? I guess that's the alternative. But instead saying, I have something to bring to the table to help this community who is trying to achieve their own goals, not my goals, and not me extracting their goals so I can go build something, but allow them to do so. And I have a contribution that I could make as well. Like, that's very different.
It is really different. And I think that a lot of the tools that we learn through, you know, the practices of user research, through, you know, people-centered design in government, and I imagine in other industries, can really be applied to the stakeholders as well. You know, in government, if you are a person, let's say you're a person who works for the government, you survived the launch of the Affordable Care Act, where many states kind of rejiggered all of their Medicaid and health insurance systems. If they built their own exchange, it was incredibly painful for a lot of folks. You know, and you kind of have this experience where engaging with your constituents is a really fraught kind of undertaking. You may have learned, maybe not super consciously, that engaging with users and launching technology is terrifying.
Right.
You know, and your constituents have learned that government technology and processes are not only not to be trusted, but they're sort of, they're like adversarial almost. You have to go in with your guard up. You really got to keep your eyes out for where you can go wrong. You know, it's like you lawyer your way through this process. And so we've got these two groups who fundamentally do not trust each other. And even if they've, like, hired us, maybe don't fully trust the process and the approach that we're suggesting. So I think, you know, applying that empathy to where our stakeholders are and kind of meeting them where they are and saying, like, okay, well, what is the most important thing here? The most important thing is that we are incorporating the perspective of people who will use this, and that we are launching responsibly and incrementally. Like, we're iteratively putting something out into the world. And there are a lot of ways to achieve that, right? And there are ways that we can make that safer and smaller at first and expand it over time, kind of for both of those parties. And so I think as a designer in a field like this, you really need to get comfortable with the idea that the way that your research and your testing and your launch strategy looks on this project may not be, like, by the textbook exactly, you know, 100%. Instead, you're going to need to adapt these tools to achieve those goals, and to kind of meet everyone in the system where they are, you know, in a way that kind of sets us on the path to that longer term vision.
Yeah. No, that's great. That's, yeah, quite a challenge. But still, yeah, no, that's wonderful.
That's what designers are made for.
It's exactly, you know? That's where I was, my head was going. I was like big, meaty, juicy problem. Wonderful, wonderful. One of the things that I have been struck with in myself, so I moved countries a few years ago. I live in the UK. One of the things that surprised me pleasantly was the degree to which the UK's government's digital presence was so consistent and, dare I say, good. You know, it's not to say there's not bureaucracy and you can't find yourself in loops and, you know, things like that. But overall, there was just an outrageous consistency. And I know some of the people that were involved, you know, 15 years ago, even 20 years ago, that laid some of that groundwork. And I think one of the things, you know, with my own experience, having spent most of my life in America, was like, oh, they don't have states here. Like, that's a big difference in that, like, you can kind of figure out this problem once and not 50 times and try to stitch them together and all of that. But anyway, I raise that because I know you have done some thinking around pattern languages and stop for service design and, you know, and things like that. And I wonder if where you find a hope for some kind of standardization or at least consistency across government's digital services.
Yeah. I mean, I first want to say that I am also really envious of the UK's digital presence and sometimes need to remind myself that I think the UK's got like a little over 65 million people. We're in about that range, and that, you know, that's the size of like Medicare in the US, like an equivalent number of people are just on Medicare in this one program in the US. And you're right. Like we love states' rights. We love, you know. Like,
well, when I agree with the issue, then I do. Yeah. Else, I'm a big federalist. If I don't,
you know.
Yeah, for sure.
And so we have kind of all of these different expressions of the same thing in the U.S. Because we are trying to drive, you know, toward more and more local governance in a lot of cases. The places that I see opportunity in the U.S., because I don't think this model is going to go away for the U.S.
Right.
anytime soon, is there are a number of just solved problems. I think that as an industry, if we can move toward like we've solved this, we don't need to solve it again. I think we'll just make it easier to build really high quality digital services, and it will be faster. For instance, some solved problems that we have are like login.gov has solved how do we make a secure system for people to kind of sign in to a public service? You know, what are all the things we need for identity proofing? What are kind of the management systems we need for that? But still, a lot of teams kind of get hung up on that part of the process, which is just a pattern that exists everywhere on the internet. And, you know, from my perspective, is not worth my time as a designer. We solved this one,
right.
You know, but it's very difficult, you know, from an implementation perspective and from an engineering perspective, and often sucks up a lot of time in these projects where we need to create a public service where, you know, for better or worse, you're going to have to log in. It's got to be secure. You know, so there are patterns like that. There are patterns like the uploader that I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. You know, find me a government service that doesn't require proof of something about you. You know, these are just sort of component parts that the experience should be very predictable. You know, the patterns that we use for them should be more or less just sort of recognizable out of the box. And this, you know, is not just true in government. This is true across the internet. When we find a good pattern, there is a lot of leverage to be gained by using something that people recognize. And they're like, ah, yes, this little hamburger button. I know what to do with that. You know, and I think in public services, there's a really big opportunity to kind of, you know, connect back to that trust and predictability aspect of things where we're making it easy. This looks like the rest of the internet, you know, mm-hmm. that you're using all the time. And therefore, like, you don't have to think about it. You can just use this and you can go back to your day, because I'm sure your goal today was never like spend a lot of time on this .gov. you know.
Yeah, for sure. So I guess what I hear you saying is, let's just start with the login page. That's just a little project for the login page for the government. And from there, we'll see where we go.
Sometimes that's where you should start. I always think it's going to take longer than you think to work on the login page. That's so right. Maybe starting it early is not so bad.
That's right. Well, this is wonderful. It's a great conversation. I really appreciate it. Where can we learn a little bit more about what you're up to?
Sure. If you want to follow what I'm up to these days, you can follow me on Twitter. It's at Genevieve Gau. So Genevieve, G-A-U. And, you know, Nava is always hiring. We are growing. We are adding really cool projects to work with states and the federal government. So if you want to check us out, we're navapbc.com/careers, and you can join our team.
It's been an unprecedented number of years, but certainly with what's happened in U.S. politics, I absolutely appreciate the optimism that you're bringing to what the potential for government could be. So thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
And that's another episode of Presentable. Hey, got any questions? You can email us at hello@presentable.fm or get in touch via Twitter by following Presentable FM. We hope you've really enjoyed the show. And if you do, could you take a moment and give us a rating on iTunes? It really helps and we'd really appreciate it. Thanks for listening. And until next time, I'm Jeffrey Veen and this was Presentable.